Big news, everyone. We just released two new training programs. First up, our second generation Strength One program, which is designed for folks who are trying to get stronger on the squat, the bench press, the deadlift, and the overhead press. It includes four 12-week programs, and users can now pick their own exercises, choose between 3 or 4 day options, and choose to focus on either the bench press or the overhead press, in addition to the squat and the deadlift. The programming has also been overhauled to drive better results based on testing and user feedback. Next, we also launched our second generation Time Crunch program, which is designed for busy professionals, parents, and other on-the-go lifters who want to maximize results without spending hours upon hours in the gym. This one includes six 12-week programs, ranging from longer workouts that are performed 2 days per week to shorter workouts performed daily and everything in between. No matter what your availability is, we have something for you. Both programs can be done with basic gym equipment like a bar, rack, and weights, but they can also be modified to use more specialized equipment in the gym if you like. Both programs also include a brand new ebook that includes details on the program, training theory, nutrition, supplements, and more. If you previously purchased the first generation of these programs, check your email for instructions on how to upgrade to the latest version. For everyone else who wants to get the most out of their training, head over to barbellmedicine.com and check out these new training programs. Here from Barbell Medicine, and we'll get to the podcast in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug a special promotion for Barbell Medicine Plus, our exclusive subscription service. From now until the end of February, we're offering 2 free months for new monthly subscribers or 40% off yearly memberships. If you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Barbell Medicine Plus members get ad-free episodes, early access to our podcast, that's both audio and video, expert-written episode summaries, extended samples to our newest templates, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, now with a discount, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Now on to the podcast. Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is another mystery case. We're going to have the second most handsome doctor in North America see if he can come up with a diagnosis without knowing what's going on. I'm just going to feed him some material from a real case report in the medical literature, and he's going to, you know, wow us with his medical acumen. On the other end of the line, you can tell by the dad noises, it's the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing well. Had a few interesting experiences. I'm finishing up 2 weeks in the hospital at the moment, and just a few things offhand I think you might find interesting or you might appreciate. One was, I think I mentioned this to you, one of my colleagues from the Department of Pulmonary and Critical Care pulled me aside to run some questions by me about his training. He's been running the powerlifting 2 template, and you know, he hit some PRs. I think he benched over 300 for the first time recently, and was pretty pleased. Was having just a little bit of some niggles he wanted some advice on I think it was like a hamstring tendon or something like that. So gave him some advice. So that was cool to see a colleague training and using the templates and wanting to expand his knowledge into proper exercise prescription for his patients who are in need of pulmonary rehabilitation, which is a topic I think I would like for us to tackle soon. So we're going to try to do that. If there are any cardiac or pulmonary rehab folks who are listening, give us a shout out. We'd be happy to chat. Another was one of my interns who pulled me aside after rounds yesterday and started asking some questions about the beginner prescription and how he might incorporate some of that alongside his busy residency life. And then lastly, so that was another attending that was one of my residents. And then lastly, I had a patient yesterday that I had admitted after they underwent a minor surgical procedure that I'll leave the details out of. And I was checking on them, making sure their pain was under control, getting them ready to discharge. And then, you know, it was by the way, as I was getting ready to leave the room, it's like, oh, I heard your podcast famous. And I was like, oh, who told you that? And so word got through to my patient who was getting the biopsy that day, and he was clearly fit and in shape. And so either someone told him about it, or maybe he was already a listener. So I had several encounters just literally in the past 72 hours with people who are in the healthcare system, follow our stuff, use our stuff. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah. Look, you're getting your social interaction with humans. You're getting, you know, there's a children's song that I'm thinking of. It's like, it's called 4 Hugs a Day. That's the minimum. I'm not going to sing it for everybody, okay. But right, yeah, it's burned into my hippocampus, and you're in the equivalent of hugs.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, let me pick your brain on this. That's pretty cool, man. I don't have those type of experiences, obviously, because I'm not in the hospital or the clinic anymore, so not in that setting. But in my own gym, which is interesting because, you know, I feel like people just know me as the guy who is staring off into space in between lifting relatively heavy weights, and his face makes weird, you know, weird caricatures when he's doing so. People come up to me, it's similar to tell me that they're running the templates. They're like, hey, I'm, you know, just finishing up Power Building 3. Like, what do you recommend next? And I'm like, oh, like, how's it going? And they're like, oh, it's awesome, man. Yeah, it's really cool how you put this all together. And this isn't an advertisement for our templates. The whole goal of our templates was just to like put forth like more accessible versions of our programming versus just one-on-one stuff. So that's why they're there. But it is cool to hear, to get that feedback. Although obviously there's some selection bias, because I don't know that anybody's going to walk up to you, to your face, and be like, hey, yeah, I was running your program and it sucks.
I mean, they're welcome to. They're welcome to. Yeah, we'd be happy to have a chat and help you troubleshoot.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be upset.
No, yeah. It's not going to, yeah. No skin off my back. I just, I'm more like just continually impressed that we have, you know, a little more reach than maybe I would otherwise estimate. And it's cool hearing from people who lift, you know? Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay, so we're going to do this mystery case, and if this is the first time you're joining us on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, these mystery cases, we do one a month usually, and it's a medical case report, it's in the literature, and it's a real case, and I present the material piecemeal to Dr. Baraki, and he kind of takes us through his thought process as a practicing physician, and it's like infotainment. So not only, you know, medical mystery stuff on TV gets a lot of views and people seem to like that sort of stuff. And this is usually connected to exercise. At the end, we sort of wrap it up with some clinical pearls for health and fitness professionals. So if you work with folks, for example, it might be useful to you as far as how you interpret and manage issues. If you're a healthcare professional, it might be something that now is on your radar that wasn't before, although we will refer you to additional resources rather than this particular podcast for that sort of stuff. And then, you know, one brief thing. Some people might say, well, you know, why are you even talking about this, you know? Let's just focus on the good stuff that exercise can do. And yeah, I'm definitely behind that. We are big promoters of exercise in the community. We would love if we had, you know, an epidemic of too many people exercising, right? But I think it is also important to point out where sort of, you know, assumptions about exercise and particularly like experiences during exercise may not actually be just, you know, rainbows and sunshine. Because there are instances where bad things can happen. And so I think actually having a fuller, a more full picture of what can happen and maybe our thought process should be almost comforting. Like, hey, look, like, yeah, there's a reason why you're experiencing this and here's what we would do about it. I don't know, is that kind of your take on maybe the application of these things rather than just for infotainment purposes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the mission of this was not only, as you said, infotainment, but also education, because I am certainly not aware of anyone else in this space who either is doing this or is arguably qualified to be talking about some of these things on the level that we're touching on them. And exercise is not risk-free. And of course, the cases we're talking about are not even necessarily like complications of exercise itself. A lot of times it's just like an exercise adjacent thing that you found interesting, and it gives us a chance to talk about something else. But I think that, yeah, it's painting a fuller picture rather than every episode being us just telling everybody how awesome exercise is, which would make for a pretty dull podcast experience. And I'd probably make a call to shut it down if that's all we did.
Yeah, to the glue factory. Yeah, fair enough. All right, well, let's get into this. So again, I'm going to present you some information, and I'll prompt the audience to maybe pause their podcast if they want to play along at home, or if they want to come up with a differential diagnosis, come up with some ideas on what we should do with the patient. It's like a choose your own adventure episode of Dr. House, minus the narcissism and like weird sort of medical responsibilities in the hospital. Like,
sure.
Again, what a cool residency that would have been. Like, you just turn up and they're like, yeah, you're doing everything. You're doing the surgeries, you're doing the and the internal medicine stuff. So, all right, here we go. Oh, I have to make a prediction about whether or not almost ruined the whole deal. I think that there is a greater than 90% chance you're going to get this. And I hope that you don't let me down, because that's a lot of confidence that I'm having in you, and just, I feel like you owe me. Okay. 38-year-old woman presents to the emergency department with chest pain that started a few hours ago. The patient states that she was doing Zumba at a fundraising event and that the pain started about 2 hours into the Zumba workout. She describes the pain as being located in the middle of her chest, underneath her sternum. It feels like heavy, throbbing pressure. She rated the pain as 6 out of 10 in intensity, which was alleviated by sublingual nitroglycerin and IV morphine that she got in the emergency department. She says that she's never had this before and she has no cardiac history. And she has no family cardiac history that she knows of. But she's concerned about her heart because she doesn't really exercise. Her past medical history is significant for hirsutism, which is excessive hair on places like the face and the scalp, which she takes spironolactone for. She's also had a history of anxiety. She was previously treated with the benzodiazepine Xanax or alprazolam. She says that this resolved about 4 years ago, and she has not taken the medication since. And she also has a remote history of smoking, where she would smoke 1 to 2 cigarettes daily for about 10 years. She quit about 5 years ago. She also recently lost 30 pounds intentionally using diet only, and her current BMI is 24. She's a social worker, and she says that she doesn't experience much stress in her life, which doesn't seem to corroborate most social workers' experience.
Exactly.
But hey, anyway, she denies any use of illicit substances. So this would be the time where if you're playing along at home that you would pause the podcast and try to figure out, you know, hey, who is this patient? Summarize who the patient is and maybe your thoughts on some potential diagnoses. With that, we'll turn it over to Dr. Baraki. So what's going on with this patient, man?
Great. Yeah. 38-year-old woman who's pretty healthy overall, coming in with, I would say, acute chest pain that onset 2 hours into an exercise session. And so this would lead us to launch into a usual differential diagnosis of chest pain, which I can get into in a moment. If I wanted to be even more specific, I mean, her chest pain specifically was in the mid-chest, what we call substernal. So like it feels like it's right below the sternum, the breast bone right in the middle, and it feels like a pressure. And it got better after they treated her with nitroglycerin and morphine at the same time. These using those muddies the picture, make a lot of things feel better. And so all of that serves to further heighten our concern. A lot of folks might see somebody who is in their 30s coming in with chest pain and might not view it as a particularly dangerous situation or be terribly worried because they're like, you're in your 30s. It's, you know, it's probably fine. Low probability for something really bad or dangerous happening. Well, people in their 30s can have all of the bad things that folks who are older can have, and they can have other things as well, because there's this thing overlap of, you know, obviously, yeah, cardiovascular disease happens more and more often as people get into their older years, but it can onset early. And then people who are in their earlier years can also still have lingering effects of maybe congenital issues that are finally deciding to show up. So it's almost like the differential diagnosis broadens in this just like pre-middle age kind of time period. Whereas by the time you get into your 80s, for example, I'm not really thinking about, oh, you have this, you know, congenital syndrome or something like that that's finally showing up. So I'm worried about all the same things and more in this 38-year-old woman. So with chest pain and certainly chest pain that's acute, we think about the heart, the lungs, basically all the things in the thorax that includes the esophagus, that includes the chest wall, the ribs, the muscles, the space in between those organs called the mediastinum, among other things. I think that right up front, when we're thinking in an emergency department style, it's going to be, what are the immediate, most life-threatening things? So that's something relating to the coronary arteries, like a heart attack, something relating to the aorta, like an aortic dissection. There are a few other kind of emergency complications that can happen with the heart. And then in the lungs, we can worry about things like a collapsed lung or a blood clot in the lungs. And then less likely in this situation is something wrong with the esophagus, like a rupture of the esophagus or other emergencies, like somebody got a fat piece of steak that's stuck in their esophagus and is obstructing it or something like that, that needs to come out pretty quickly. And so this patient immediately would get some vital signs taken, obviously have some eyes on her to see how she looks physically, and then get an electrocardiogram or an EKG, get some initial blood testing, and then we would kind of go from there. The first and most immediate thing that I would like to see in this patient is a set of vital signs and an electrocardiogram.
Well, ask and ye shall receive. So again, if you're just rejoining us here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast with Dr. Austin Baraki, so you didn't hear any of his differential diagnosis, that's fine. You're playing along at home. We'll see if you get it right. Again, the idea is you have enough stuff on the differential to ultimately arrive at the correct answer. As long as it's on there, you're good to go. So let's move on to the exam portion of this. So in the emergency department, the patient's vitals were stable. Her heart rate was between 60 and 70 beats per minute. Her respiratory rate was between 12 and 20. Her blood pressure was normal, 90 over 60. And she was satting well on room air. She's afebrile, no fever. On physical exam, the patient does appear well. She's alert and oriented. And most of her exam was normal. Specifically, she had no jugular venous distension in the neck. She had a normal cardiac exam with regular rate and rhythm, no murmurs or rubs. She had no lower extremity edema. Her pulses were intact in both legs. Her lung sounds were clear as well, and her abdominal exam was normal. Her neurological exam was also normal. She's moving all extremities well. On the EKG, showed normal sinus rhythm, no ST wave elevation or depressions. She did have T wave inversions that were seen in leads 1 and the AVL lead, along with flattening of T waves in leads V1 and V2. I'm also going to give you some troponins. So her troponins were 0.294 and 0.231 nanograms per milliliter. So those are elevated. Her chest x-ray was clear, save for pectus excavatum, which is basically that sunken chest due to a congenital chest wall deformity where the breastbone, the sternum, and ribs grow inward, creating this depression in the chest. So before we go any further, I'll give you a chance to re-summarize the patient and kind of work through your sort of thought process here. If you're playing along at home, pause again. No free tips here. If you're playing along at home, that's not how this works. So Dr. Baraki, what do you think?
Yeah. So this 38-year-old woman who, as I summarized her, said she was pretty healthy. She does have this background smoking history and sounds like she had obesity, which is now kind of put into remission, we'll say, coming in with acute substernal chest pain in the setting of exercise. The added information you gave me, vital signs mostly reassuring. You said her blood pressure was 90 over 60. That is questionably normal. It kind of depends on what the person's usual blood pressure is. There are certainly young people, thin people, they're just people who can live at that level of blood pressure and it'd be okay. But I would question that. Does she normally live higher than that? And this is actually hypotension or low blood pressure, because that's a sign of potentially impending shock, although her normal heart rate is reassuring, because if that were the case, her heart rate should be creeping up for sure. Most of the exam is unrevealing, and that's really commonly the case in patients with acute chest pain. It's not often that the manifestations of their cardiac or their pulmonary disease necessarily kind of rise to the surface, so to speak, unless they're in florid heart failure and we can hear fluid in their lungs, or they have a collapsed lung and we can't hear a breath sound on one side or the other. Most of the time, the exam in patients with acute chest pain is actually pretty normal. As far as the electrocardiogram goes, what we'll call non-specific changes, T-wave inversions, there's a list of about 15 things that I will spare the audience that can cause T-wave inversions. Some of them, ischemia, like, if somebody's having a heart attack can do that. Pulmonary embolisms can cause T-wave inversions. Certain electrolyte abnormalities like low potassium and a bunch of other things can cause T-wave inversions. I'm going to set the rest aside for now, but the money here, the clear source of concern is that her blood troponin level is detectable. And that's a protein that comes from the muscle cells of the heart. And so all this elevation tells us is that something is injuring those muscle cells in her heart, which is abnormal to be detectable at all in essentially anyone, and is especially abnormal to be detectable in somebody who's 38 years old and coming in with acute chest pain in the setting of exercise. So I have concerns. The question, though, that remains, what we have not yet figured out, is why are these cardiac muscle cells getting injured? When they get injured and they pop and they die, this protein gets released into the blood. So all we know, all I can say so far, is that she's having evidence of what we'll call acute myocardial injury. That's the fancy phrase that we say when we have this kind of troponin elevation of unclear cause. You can have this because you got punched really hard in the chest. You can have this because your heart is straining against really high blood pressure. You can have this because it's straining against really, in the setting of severe high blood pressure or a pulmonary embolism, or I've seen, you will see troponins that get elevated from a stroke, from all sorts of different things. The thing we think about first and foremost is this person having a heart attack or coronary occlusion, where one of the blood vessels that provides oxygen to their heart muscle is blocked, leading these muscle cells to die and release this enzyme. But there's a lot of different potential sources of this. The things that need to happen next for this patient is first of all, it's good that she is currently chest pain free. She has been treated and is not actively having ongoing chest pain. These blood levels would be continually monitored. She would get serial electrocardiograms over time. Most of the time, a cardiologist would get involved. And if the story is concerning enough, as I would say it is in this situation, this patient would get taken off to the cardiac catheterization lab. This can happen in an emergency setting right away with certain types of presentations, or it might be delayed by a day or sometimes a little bit longer if it's not as emergency of a situation, because first and foremost, you want to make sure that those coronaries are open. Things that can happen to those coronaries, they can get, again, blocked by a clot. That's a more traditional kind of heart attack that people can think of. They can dissect, they can spasm, they can become occluded by an embolus. There's all sorts of things that can happen to coronaries. And if it's not due to a coronary occlusion, then that's great, but we'd have to go down to cause number two, number three, number four for why heart muscle cells can get injured. Like, could this patient have myocarditis for some reason, or make sure they don't have a pulmonary embolism or various other causes that we would get to next? So yeah, that's kind of what would happen next. A cardiologist would likely get involved in this patient either emergently or urgently, would probably get taken off to the cardiac catheterization lab. They'd probably get an echocardiogram or an ultrasound of their heart as well.
Well, I can give you a few things. And again, welcome back to our listeners who are playing along at home. They're getting, you know, at some point, maybe we should offer CMEs for these things, continuing medical education units, you know, like, oh, you got to the right diagnosis. You get, you know, 0.2 contact hours or something. So first thing I'm going to give you is, yeah, she was whisked away to the cardiac catheterization lab. There was no evidence of coronary artery disease when she was in the lab, but she did have reduced left ventricular systolic function. So that's when the heart's actually contracting, with an ejection fraction of 30 to 35% in the cath lab. She got an echocardiogram, was also done, showed hypokinesis, so reduced movement of apical and mid-distal walls of the left ventricle, as well as hyperdynamic basal walls of the left ventricle. So it was moving a little too much down there. And the ejection fraction was 35 to 40%, all consistent with what the Reed called apical ballooning syndrome. So if you're playing along at home, this is the time to also pause, because you got to come up with a diagnosis, which I will also challenge you with, Dr. Austin Baracchi, based on this new information, some thoughts about this patient, and a diagnosis, por favor.
Yes. So the description that you gave me rapidly brought this diagnosis to the forefront of my mind, even before you described the syndrome on that echocardiogram. So this is a situation where a patient comes in with a syndrome that looks for all the world like a heart attack. They can have EKG changes that can look like it. They can have the blood levels that make it look like you're having a heart attack. And then you go to that cath lab and they do the procedure and they see no clot or blockage or occlusion of any of your coronary arteries. But with this particular pattern of how the heart muscle is moving, squeezing, areas where it's moving well, areas where it's not moving well, and definitely with that kind of textbook phrase of apical ballooning, this is something that, I don't know if you timed it for shortly after I got back from Japan, but this is a syndrome called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, or stress cardiomyopathy, or what in the lay press is often termed broken heart syndrome. That's because this is something that it's not super well understood. And she is, I would say, on the young side to present with this. More often we see it in slightly older women have a predominance of this condition for reasons that are not entirely clear. The vast majority happen in the setting of a kind of a profound psychophysiologic stress of some kind. A lot of the time it's negative. Interestingly, about, I think, like 10 to 15% of the time it can happen in settings of like profound positive emotional experiences, which is really unfortunate. And it leads to basically the syndrome that looks just like a heart attack, but isn't. And overall, the prognosis is actually pretty good for patients in this situation. There obviously are some exceptions, but this is something that I see a couple times a year, maybe in a hospitalized setting. I think a cardiologist or somebody working in a cardiac ICU would see it probably a little bit more frequently, but it's something that's always on our minds. This is Takotsubo stress cardiomyopathy, quote unquote, broken heart syndrome case in this slightly unusually young woman to have this particular condition.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. when you're trapped in a cycle of stressful, unwanted thoughts and repetitive behaviors that are taking over your life. That's how it can feel for individuals with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, which is so much more than the stereotypes about liking things clean and organized. It's a seriously and highly misunderstood condition with two main symptoms: intrusive thoughts and compulsions that cause anxiety or distress. The intrusive thoughts are unwanted thoughts that feel disturbing, stressful, and totally out of character. They can be about anything, but often focus on people or things that we care about, making them hard to ignore. People with OCD often feel like they have to do something to relieve the anxiety from those thoughts. So they'll engage in compulsions, which are repetitive physical or mental behaviors like checking, asking for assurance, following strict routines, or mentally reviewing things over and over. Because there are so many misconceptions, a lot of people don't know that they have it, and they feel shame about their symptoms and suffer in silence. Plus, not every therapist understands OCD or is qualified to treat it effectively, which can make it difficult to find the right help. I can't stress enough how important it is to get the right kind of care, because just like a great workout program can transform your body, the right mental health care can transform your mind, and ultimately, the individual's life. OCD is highly treatable with a specialized type of therapy called ERP, or exposure and response prevention. With NoCD, you can do live, virtual ERP therapy with licensed therapists who specialize in ERP and OCD, so they can truly understand what you're going through, even the symptoms that feel hard to talk about. NoCD makes this life-changing treatment affordable and accepts more than 60 insurance plans, enabling over 155 million Americans to access evidence-based treatment at NoCD covered by insurance. And between therapy sessions, you'll have NoCD's powerful in-app support. If you or someone you love is struggling with OCD, you're not alone, and with the right care, you can get better. To find out more about therapy with NoCD, go to nocd.com and book a free 15-minute call with their team. That's nocd.com to learn more and book a free call. This episode is sponsored by Acorns. Last year, Save More Money was the most popular New Year's resolution in America. Now, clearly, a lot of us feel like our money is slipping through our fingers, and it's a good thing there's Acorns. Acorns hopes to grow your money into more of your money. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing so your money has a chance to grow for you, your kids, and your retirement. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that fits you and your money goals. You also don't need to be rich, and you don't need a ton of time. Acorns lets you invest with the spare money you've got right now, as little as $5, and start investing in just 5 minutes. Basically, Acorns does the hard part so you can give your money a chance to grow. Now, financial stress can certainly play a big role in health, and Acorns gives you small, simple steps to get you and your financial wellness on track. Head to acorns.com/BBM or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. This is a paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/BBM. This podcast is brought to you by Factor Meals. While we all know that nutrition is huge when it comes to health and performance, we don't always have time to shop for and prepare healthy meals. Are you ready to optimize your nutrition this year? Let Factor help you take the stress out of eating healthy so that you can hit your goals. Skip the grocery store, skip the prep work and the cooking fatigue, and instead get fresh, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals delivered right to your door. Factor lets you choose from a ton of different meal plans, including 40 options across 8 different dietary patterns. When things get hectic, Factor is flexible. You can change your order up every week with plans from 4 to 18 meals per week, or pause, or even reschedule your deliveries at any time. And check this out, Factor is cheaper than eating takeout and dining out. Reach your goals this year with ingredients you can trust and convenience that can't be beat. If you want a helping hand with your nutrition, head to factormeals.com/factorpodcast and use code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/factorpodcast to get 50% off. Yeah, no, correct. Yeah, thank you for making my prediction correct that you would get the right answer, the right diagnosis. So she was diagnosed with Takotsubo cardiomyopathy after fulfilling all 4 of the Mayo Clinic's diagnostic criteria. We'll talk about that shortly. She was treated with a beta blocker, an ACE inhibitor, and then discharged with a life vest. That's just a brand name of this like wearable cardiac defibrillator.
Yes.
She wore it for a whole month. Because that's when her follow-up was with the cardiologist for a repeat echocardiogram. That's the ultrasound of the heart. Uh-huh. She had no chest pain, no shortness of breath in the interim, and her ejection fraction rose to 60 to 65% at that time, which is more on the normal side. And at that point, the life vest was discontinued. I'd actually not seen the latest versions of these life vests. And I just did a little quick reconnaissance here. 0 out of 10.
Yeah.
I would hate to wear that thing on a daily basis. Obviously I would in this particular situation, because that's got to be, somewhat frightening, I suspect. But wow. I don't know. The idea of just wearing that around your day-to-day life and just being like, because people are going to say, hey, you've been working out.
you looking jacked. Yeah, they're not new. I mean, I remember back in, you know, in training a decade ago, having patients who had, you know, really significant reductions in their ejection fraction, or who were at high risk of dangerous arrhythmias, but maybe who for whatever reason could not get an implantable defibrillator put into their bodies, or maybe who didn't need an implantable defibrillator put into their bodies because of this very type of situation. If the prognosis is good enough that we feel their heart will likely recover, then you can spare them putting in a very expensive implantable device into their body that can lead to subsequent complications. Those devices can sometimes get infected and all sorts of other gnarly things that I have the unfortunate pleasure of sometimes dealing with in the hospitalized setting. But this case, as I said, is one that the prognosis is quite good. And so one, you know, while you're in that kind of more tenuous state, you can wear a temporary defibrillator. And that's something that for the audience who might be unfamiliar, you know, when you watch medical TV dramas and somebody's heart rhythm goes into a particular type of dangerous rhythm and they, you know, put the pads on the chest and yell clear and shock them, that's what this pad does in a kind of more automated fashion. And there are certain situations where patients will have a condition where they actually have to have one of these defibrillators permanently implanted into their chest, kind of in a similar way to a pacemaker, but not exactly with the same type of function. And so, yeah, since this was a high risk kind of period for her, I mean, I guess arguably, I'm not sure that she in 100% of cases with an ejection fraction, you know, if her EF was say over 35, that you would necessarily need that, but that's details here. But she got out of the woods. Her heart recovered, as I would expect in this situation, with some of the use of those medicines and just time. And then she didn't need it anymore. So spared her implanting a device. And, you know, this kind of a situation, probably not much she could have done to avoid it. Probably, you know, I would not like restrict this person from exercise moving forward. I might just, because she went through this, refer to cardiac rehabilitation anyway and suggest that she go through a more graded return to activity if she had no like habitual exercise prior and then she jumped into like a 2-hour or longer, it sounds like, continuous Zumba session before her chest pain onset. Maybe we needed a little bit more of an on-ramp, but still I would hesitate to like confidently tie the two together just to mitigate like fear of activity in this person. I would still say that exercise meeting guidelines or working up to them gradually over time would still be the healthiest thing for this person. And if they needed some guidance, working through cardiac rehab or a knowledgeable clinician coach like we would be able to help this person with could get her back to activity, and she should be okay long term. Yeah.
We're definitely going to talk about like exercise, return to exercise, or in this particular case, like initiation of exercise, because it doesn't seem like she was really doing much before, and maybe some unique opportunities in the clinic to do so. But yeah, let's do a little rehash on like what this actually is and maybe some risk factors, some pathophysiology. So yeah, get your glasses on. It's time to nerd out here on Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. It's also known as stress-induced cardiomyopathy, apical ballooning syndrome. I was plus or minus on whether or not to include that phrase.
I would have got it if you hadn't told me. Yes. It's all good.
Yeah. Or broken heart syndrome, as you said. Shout out Valentine's Day. It's also, again, Heart Awareness Month, in America. So
in case you're aware. Not aware of your heart. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a syndrome characterized by reduced function of the left ventricle during systole. So while the heart is actually contracting, and as you mentioned, it kind of mimics a heart attack or an MI, a myocardial infarction, but there's no evidence of something blocking the coronary arteries. And so when she was clear in the cath lab and then the echocardiogram, at that point, you're like, oh, I know exactly what this is, which is relatively rare in medicine that you can just like, oh, wow, one negative finding and you're like, cool, I know exactly what it is. The most common presenting symptoms are this acute substernal chest pain, so below the sternum, but some patients also present with this sort of dyspnea, so this shortness of breath and syncope, so lightheadedness, but it does tend to mimic what most people would associate with a conventional heart attack type of symptoms. The term Takotsubo, do you know what this is from? Dr. Yeah. Baraki?
Yeah, it's a Japanese term relating to an octopus trap and the appearance of the heart when it has that ballooning kind of appearance. It, I guess, at one point was thought to mimic the appearance of this kind of Japanese octopus trap. So there you go.
Yeah, unfamiliar really with the Japanese octopus traps and how those differ maybe from other regions where octopi are trapped. Yeah. But anyway, any case, yeah, that's why it's got the name. This was first described in the 1990s, if you can believe that, in Japan, and has since been increasingly recognized around the world. It occurs in like 1-2% of patients presenting with a suspected heart attack that has positive cardiac markers like troponin. That's kind of what we're talking about, that protein that's released when the cardiac tissue is damaged. It is, as you mentioned, much more common in women than men, particularly postmenopausal women, so a little bit older. The International Takotsubo Registry, which is a consortium of 26 different centers in Europe and the United States, including just under 2,000 patients, showed that 90% were women and the mean age was 66. So as you said, relatively young, but definitely the right gender for this. Pathophysiology, as you again alluded to, not definitively understood. The main provoking factor is thought to be this sort of stress-induced release of catecholamines. So that would be like norepinephrine, dopamine, and epinephrine. Whereas other mechanisms include like coronary artery spasm, vascular dysfunction. But ultimately, the thought is that these are caused by maybe catecholamine excess, having too much norepinephrine or epinephrine and/or dopamine, for example. So as an example, there's a condition called pheochromocytoma, which is an adrenal gland tumor that produces way too many catecholamines, which you can measure in the blood. And yeah, people can have this particular condition with pheochromocytoma. Also, I saw that it happens sometimes in septic patients due to the stress of being in sepsis.
Yeah, when I said that I see stress cardiomyopathy probably a couple times a year, more often it's in that kind of a situation where they have this profound physiologic stress from sepsis, and then that leads to this, you know, cardiac dysfunction and kind of apical ballooning appearance. I would say less often do I see the absolute textbook, you know, my spouse died as a postmenopausal woman and then coming in with this prototypical presentation. Certainly see it from time to time, but more often it's in the setting of like major physiologic stressors that I would see it in the inpatient setting. Yeah.
Yeah, the big giveaway here, again, was that there are no like obstructive lesions or spasms that were noted when she was in the coronary cath lab, you know, so the coronary arteries were basically clear. EKG abnormalities are common, although this patient didn't really have anything super specific, but about half of individuals with this particular condition will have EKG changes that are consistent with what would be a regular heart attack or myocardial infarction. And the troponins are usually elevated, which is interesting because I think the thing that we keep saying over and over again is we're like, well, look, you know, it's not a typical heart attack, for example. And so, you know, there's no obstruction, but they still get this troponin leak. And you know, it wasn't clear to me. I did some digging. It wasn't clear to me why there would be this sort of troponin elevation. It's like, is it because the catecholamine excess, this excess adrenaline, for example, is causing the heart to work a little bit overtime, for example, or it's just because there's, you know, areas of the left ventricle that aren't working normally, and so they were damaged by the catecholamine excess, but just nothing in the actual vessels? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that part of the challenge here, and this extends beyond just this category, but when we do a heart catheterization, we being cardiologists do a heart catheterization, really what you're looking at are mostly the large, what are called like the epicardial coronary vessels. So they're the big ones. And even the big ones are small, like in absolute terms, right? But like the main, you know, you'll hear people talk about like, oh, the widow maker or the left main coronary artery or the right main coronary artery. Those are the big honking ones that like, yeah, if those are occluded or, you know, obstructed for some reason, that's kind of more concerning. But there are so many tiny microvessels, perforators, all sorts of very tiny, tiny, tiny vessels that are feeding, you know, the heart muscle. And those are not readily apparent on a heart catheterization by any means. And so if you have more what would be called like microvascular dysfunction, which is actually probably more common than it's historically been given credit for, that's not something that would appear on a heart cath. And so at least part of the theorized mechanism in this situation relates to probably having some microvascular dysfunction. So the tiny little blood vessels, something's, you know, they're not working right. Maybe they're spasmed because of the effects of catecholamines, whatever the case is. Ultimately, you end up with muscle cell death of the heart muscles. That's again why that's the only way by which troponin gets released into the blood. It's just that there are multiple different ways that you could get there. So in what we're calling a typical heart attack, you lose oxygenated blood flow to the heart muscle, you know, more often because of a blockage in one of the large, again, epicardial coronary vessels. But you can also have muscle cell death in that situation for other reasons not related to a blockage of one of those big vessels, tiny vessels that are, you know, not supplying sufficient oxygenated blood, or the strain against super high blood pressures, or all these other things that I mentioned earlier. So that's my thought.
Yeah, there's also even some evidence where various troponins can be elevated after exercise, in fact. So yeah, there's just a number of different ways that you can get there, as you've mentioned a few times. As far as risk factors go, yep, you kind of mentioned this. I don't really know how you can prevent this from most causes. I think there's a genetic sort of connection here. Also, psychiatric conditions have been associated with increased sort of risk. So things like affective disorders and or anxiety, or neurological conditions like seizures, headache sort of syndromes. But there seems to be maybe a bigger risk from various medications. Yeah. So for example, dobutamine is a medication that, yeah, I saw that a number of times in the literature, because it kind of acts as a catecholamine. So the idea is that if it's given in excess, people can have this response, perhaps if they're vulnerable to it. This particular patient was on spironolactone, which is an aldosterone antagonist. So it blocks what aldosterone does. It's an androgen receptor blocker, also decreases testosterone levels, which is why this patient was taking it for hirsutism. Mm-hmm. It seems also, though, to increase sympathetic activity of the heart via multiple different mechanisms, which is why it's often used in congestive heart failure, for example. So it might have played a role here between being unfamiliar with exercise, and so perhaps having like an elevated sympathetic nervous system, your fight or flight response to exercise, plus mm-hmm. having this kind of on board maybe sensitized her. That's, I'm speculating here, but I'm just trying to think, yeah, like, why did this happen in this young individual?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a leap that I would not feel comfortable making in practice. But it would come back to recommendations, like I said, of a more gentle on ramp to activity. I mean, if you were like, what can I do if I'm most terrified in my life of developing this condition? It's like, well, don't ever get too sad. Don't ever get too happy. Don't ever do anything too hard. It's like,
yeah,
unhelpful advice in general.
Yeah, do the Phineas Gage thing. Just, you know, have no affect.
Yeah,
just be, you know, yeah, vanilla the rest of your life. I also did some digging, again, because, you know, I was curious about what other sort of like exercise related or maybe exercise adjacent conditions have led to this in some case reports. And there's a number of them with anabolic steroid use. And so the thought here is that many of these anabolic androgenic steroids actually increase sort of catecholamine sensitivity in various tissues, particularly the cardiorespiratory system, cardiovascular system, and also maybe induce a little bit of vascular sort of dysfunction in and around the heart in some maybe vulnerable individuals. There was one case, this 25-year-old dude who was taking Winstrol and Decadurabol and for 3 weeks, and ultimately developed Takotsubo's from that. And yeah, that was the, you know, the author's sort of thought was like, maybe they sensitized him to catecholamine excess, but ultimately still kind of unknown. But yeah, if you were wondering, like, do anabolic steroids like increase or decrease the risk of having, you know, some sort of cardiac issue, likely increases. I think you'd feel comfortable saying that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the reason is that we talked about the usual distribution of who gets this. It's like the overwhelming majority is like older postmenopausal women. And so to the extent that you're seeing like a young male get it, I'm looking for something weird about them that's a trigger, right? And so if that's something that's, you know, if they're taking it, then even though I don't have a strong way to like definitively prove that relationship, but I'm like, you are so far of an exception to who gets this condition that I have to think that they're at least a high likelihood of a relationship there.
Yep. As far as diagnosis goes, the Mayo Clinic diagnostic criteria is pretty much the gold standard here. So you need all four of these things to be for diagnosis. So you need to have some sort of transient left ventricular dysfunction during the systolic phase of the heart, so when it's contracting. So it could be hypokinesis, akinesis, dyskinesis. Those are all fancy ways of saying it's not moving normally, right? It's not functioning normally. An absence of obstructive coronary disease. So again, clear sort of coronary vessels. And no sort of vasospasm there, for example. New electrocardiographic abnormalities or a modest elevation in cardiac troponins, which is what we saw both of those here, and absence of pheochromocytoma, that's that tumor of the adrenal gland, or myocarditis, which you would have picked up on echocardiogram. So she got 4 out of 4 and earned this diagnosis. Do you think they said to her like, hey, you have broken heart syndrome, are you okay?
Not how I would usually deliver this diagnosis. That would not be the bedside manner that I would teach, but yeah, worth asking. Maybe. If she's okay.
Yeah. As far as management goes, this is generally the sort of transient short-lived disorder managed mostly by supportive therapy. So conservative treatment and resolution of either the stress, if there was something that kind of, was here at onset. Usually that correlates with the resolution of symptoms, although some patients will develop acute complications that require further treatment. It's kind of beyond the scope of this particular podcast. What I really wanted to focus on for the remainder of this is kind of like, all right, well, what do we do about exercise post, after something like this? And I actually think that's kind of where our niche really lies here because of the medical training, but then also the experience with coaching, right? So, there are thousands, tens of thousands of medical conditions out there, and most of them don't have specific sort of exercise recommendations or guidelines to either reduce the sort of burden of disease or prevent the risk of developing that disease. Most of these people can be managed like they actually don't have that medical condition. You just train them like a normal person. What do they want to do? What can they do? What sort of access do they have? And sort of go, what do they respond to? Just how you would normally coach folks. This particular individual, I would be very surprised, however, if she wasn't absolutely terrified of exercise after this experience.
Yes.
She's recently lost weight, so you feel like she's health conscious, right? She stopped smoking, this, that, and the other. And then she goes and does something that she would assume to be low impact, low intensity. It's a multi-hour Zumba class at a fundraiser event, right?
Yeah.
It's not like they're doing like Murph or something like that. And then she has what she assumes to be and probably understands to be a heart attack.
Yes.
And so I think this is a unique clinical opportunity to not only give somebody an accurate lay of the land with respect to exercise risks and benefits, but also provide reassurance and schedule further follow-up to see how somebody's doing, because they probably do need that extra care. I think I would personally start with, some sort of education stuff where, broadly speaking, the benefits of exercise are wide-reaching. Virtually every system in the body is positively affected from exercise. The risks are not zero, but they're relatively low. And so to the extent that we predict that you're going to have a favorable response to exercise or experience some sort of unwanted side effect, we would predict mostly positive stuff. But that doesn't mean that nothing can happen. So to avoid these risks, here's what we would recommend. And Ed, you've mentioned it a number of times in this particular instance. It would be a more graded, gradual exposure to exercise, probably with some monitoring in this individual. Now, whether that's done through a formalized process like cardiac rehab, where they hook them up, monitor their heart rate, their blood pressure, and other various things while they're in sort of a clinical setting, that's one option. But if this was all going to be done outpatient, you could make a case for some sort of heart rate monitor and, various sort of, almost like a checklist, like, hey, look, measure your blood pressure at home, for example, check your heart rate. And if you're experiencing these symptoms, call us, for example. I don't know. How would you go about kind of setting some parameters for like, it's okay to exercise if you experience this versus this? And how would you have that conversation?
Yeah, I mean, this patient overall, as I mentioned, and as was, proven in her course, has a very good prognosis for several reasons. She's young. She didn't have a ton of other comorbid conditions. She was started on medicines afterwards that are generally helpful in situations of heart failure, particularly when the person's ejection fraction or the amount their heart is squeezing is reduced. And in general, even though this condition, Takotsubo cardiomyopathy or stress cardiomyopathy, it can recur. That rate of recurrence is pretty low, and the risk factors for it recurring, she does not tend to have many of them. So like older men with chronic kidney disease and diabetes and like all sorts of other, advanced comorbid conditions that she does not have. So this is something that, to your point, I mean, I would be in my own personal practice, because I do this kind of thing, I would have this conversation with her actually before her leaving the hospital, recognizing that she is likely to be very fearful about this, about returning to activity, about doing much of anything. And so it would effectively end up mimicking kind of a motivational interviewing conversation, because I think it's very unlikely that she's going to go out and wildly overdo it, right? just based on the story, the experience, right? It doesn't seem like she's itching to get out there and do like heavy Fran or something like that, right? And so I might have to actually open it up and negotiate with like, what are you, you know, willing to, what kind of activity do you enjoy doing? And then trying to find some appropriate initial dose. And I agree, whether or not it is firmly established in the research literature as like a useful way to go about it, potentially using something like a heart rate monitor and just making up some kind of like an upper threshold for the first week, for the second week, for the third week. So it just makes it so that she feels in control of what's happening. She can adjust the intensity in real time to say cap her heart rate for the first week at whatever. Again, I mean, it's going to be mostly, you know, made up, but and then bump that up gradually over time as her conditioning improves and as her condition recovers. Now, I probably still wouldn't jump right into this like the first couple days after hospitalization for something like this while her heart is still in like very early recovery mode. The same thing would apply if somebody had myocarditis. That's actually a situation where I would actually restrict them pretty significantly and potentially for a bit longer than, you know, just a few days. It'd probably be a multi-week long kind of restriction before we return to activity, but it should have some kind of parameters to basically guardrails around intensity and duration for these patients. And so if they have access to something like cardiac rehab, that can provide a monitored kind of more formalized setting. It is admittedly sometimes challenging to get into cardiac rehab, or there might be delays, or there might be insurance issues, things like that, in which case we have to come up with the next best thing, which a lot of clinicians don't feel terribly comfortable doing, where we would use basic principles of exercise prescription. I would start with very low intensity conditioning work. Again, restricted in some way, whether using autoregulation strategies like a talk test or a heart rate cap or something like that, and an arbitrarily low overall duration, and then extend that out gradually week over week until we're ready to start doing some more strength work and then building that up from there. That would be the overall, what my overall approach would be in a patient like this.
Yeah, that's the issue that, you know, what people are looking for when either they or a client or a loved one are trying to start initiate exercise after some sort of diagnosis, right? Specific diagnosis. They're like, well, what do you recommend? And by and large, these are going to be made up. To the extent that you can pull from various evidence-based strategies, you know, that's a relatively small subset within this sort of exercise medicine, you know, Venn diagram that meets in the middle. You know, there's a handful of things for heart failure. There's a handful of things for like post MI, so cardiac rehab, stroke rehab. But even then, it's not like the data is like super definitive. Like you must start at this intensity and this sort of volume and this frequency or whatever. It's more like, well, this is what we think, you know, you should do based on kind of what we've already been doing for a period of time. And so, look, if people want us to come up with exercise guidelines for every medical condition that maybe requires some sort of specialized management, I mean, we can do it. It's going to take us a while. And so I think maybe a general sort of heuristic here is like, if somebody has a diagnosis that requires hospitalization, at that point, you've sort of, you know, don't pass go, do not collect $200. It probably requires some sort of clearance in order to get back to unrestricted activity. Now, whether that's just going to see the doctor, you know, your outpatient doctor a few weeks or a month after you were admitted and getting a sort of clean bill of health, that may be one thing. If it requires, you know, some sort of exposure to a formalized rehab program, like after a heart attack or a stroke, that's another thing. Or if it requires something to be made up, you know, fine. But I think at that point, if that's happened, I don't know that we can just say, look, there are no risks, just carry on. That would probably be irresponsible. By the same token, it would be irresponsible to say that you can never exercise again.
Totally.
You know, yeah. Or to fail to address that. And I think that's probably my biggest issue with the sort of system right now, because like you mentioned, you would do this while the person's in the hospital, before they left.
Most clinicians, this would not be a conversation with the patient prior to discharge, unfortunately, just being real with it.
Yeah. Ideally, you'd have some conversation like, look, here are your current exercise restrictions, if any, but you should exercise up to this level. Now, if it's full, like contraindication, you cannot exercise, well, there needs to be some sort of a plan in place to remove that restriction, because that's incompatible with living an independent life. I would also, you know, if I got to choose, I would say maybe a little nutrition discussion in there if there are ways to benefit the particular condition or otherwise general health of the patient. Those two things should be like quality improvement projects that should be implemented. That ideally, that would happen in every person who goes into and then leaves the hospital. But I'm not optimistic that that would change until the system changes. And so, you know, all right, we don't have to hem and haw about that too much. But I do think, yeah, we put a pretty good plan together for this particular patient, especially with the providing reassurance and education. I think it would be as inappropriate as it would be to like not discuss exercise at all. It would also be inappropriate to say, and look, there are no risks from exercise, period. So carry on. Because this person just experienced one of the potential bad outcomes that may be exercise adjacent. And so the idea that they can like divorce themselves from that experience and just live, you know, without remembering it.
Yeah,
unlikely.
I mean, it reminds me of, you know, other issues that we deal with in our pain and rehab population. If they had a pretty significant acute pain or acute injury in the context of a, you know, a given activity, you know, there's some memory and fear associated with returning to that type of activity naturally. So, and that involves a lot of work and conversations and handholding and graded exposure to work back up to things that are potentially traumatic. If you had an acute, you know, disc herniation, if you had an acute muscle tear, if you had, you know, a fracture, a broken bone, some, you know, something like that, then it's going to be tough for you to jump right back into doing what you were doing before. Not that it may not even necessarily be advisable. Maybe the way you went about it or the way that you approached it might need modification, but that fear is quite normal and expected and needs some time to work through. And I expect something similar might be the case for this patient, unless she's extremely stoic, which did not appear to be the case based on her prior medical history of anxiety that required treatment.
Yeah, exactly. So I think some assurance, some education, start that process early, get the person back to moving. Ultimately, the idea is unrestricted activity if she can tolerate it. And yeah, there we go. All right. Well, look, that's a wrap here on our mystery case from February 2025. Special shout out to Dr. Austin Baracchi for joining us on this edition of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. Catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Big news, everyone. We just released two new training programs. First up, our second generation Strength One program, which is designed for folks who are trying to get stronger on the squat, the bench press, the deadlift, and the overhead press. It includes 4 12-week programs, and users can now pick their own exercises, choose between 3 or 4 day options, and choose to focus on either the bench press or the overhead press, in addition to the squat and the deadlift. The programming has also been overhauled to drive better results based on testing and user feedback. Next, we also launched our second generation Time Crunch program, which is designed for busy professionals, parents, and other on-the-go lifters who want to maximize results without spending hours upon hours in the gym. This one includes 6 12-week programs, ranging from longer workouts that are performed 2 days per week to shorter workouts performed daily and everything in between. No matter what your availability is, we have something for you. Both programs can be done with basic gym equipment like a bar, rack, and weights, but they can also be modified to use more specialized equipment in the gym if you like. Both programs also include a brand new ebook that includes details on the program, training theory, nutrition, supplements, and more. If you previously purchased the first generation of these programs, check your email for instructions on how to upgrade to the latest version. For everyone else who wants to get the most out of their training, head over to barbellmedicine.com and check out these new training programs. Here from Barbell Medicine, and we'll get to the podcast in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug a special promotion for Barbell Medicine Plus, our exclusive subscription service. From now until the end of February, we're offering 2 free months for new monthly subscribers or 40% off yearly memberships. If you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Barbell Medicine Plus members get ad-free episodes, early access to our podcast, that's both audio and video, expert written episode summaries, extended samples to our newest templates, access to a members only podcast where Dr. Baracchi and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member now with a discount, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Now on to the podcast.